Swedish-British journalist, filmmaker, political writer, and author of 5 books, Pelle Nyroff-Taylor, on today's News Talk, TNT.
And welcome back to today's News Talk. This is the Pelle Nyroff-Taylor Show with me, Basil Valentine, holding the reins for a few minutes. Pelle has a slight technical issue, but I was going to talk about this anyway, with or without Pelle, and that is the Freedom Flotilla setting sail with aid to Gaza, which is currently preparing for departure from Turkey. This press release from Ankara today: organizers of a new Freedom Flotilla with humanitarian shipment for the Gaza Strip continue preparations for its upcoming departure, despite reports of talks between Turkey and Israel to change the route. This, according to Turkish Humanitarian Relief Foundation, IHH, speaking to the Sputnik news agency. Very little of this, I should add, on any of the Western corporate media outlets. I've seen posts on the X platform by 2 former guests of today's News Talk, Sarah Wilkinson, the British humanitarian and human rights campaigner, and Medea Benjamin of Code Pink, who was famously a guest on the Patrick Henningsen show a few weeks ago, and who regularly doorsteps members of Congress and asks them about their continued support for genocide. A very brave Jewish lady, Medea Benjamin. And I've seen that she is on board ship, getting ready to go, as is Sarah Wilkinson. There are about 50 individuals, volunteers, and 5.5 tons of aid. I think that was the figure I heard, which is a lot. They're due to depart any day for the Gaza Strip via Egypt. But it is to be remembered, in 2010, Israeli commandos intercepted a ship after it tried to breach the previous Gaza blockade, something which resulted in the death of 10 Turkish nationals at the hands of the Israeli commandos. Now, a repeat of anything like that would be extremely bad publicity for the Israeli regime. Not that they seem to care, but if they start killing people like Sarah Wilkinson and Medea Benjamin, then a Rubicon will have been crossed. This particular flotilla is scheduled to depart on April the 24th. The Turkish Humanitarian Relief Foundation, IHH, did not previously rule out possible problems with the flotilla's attempts to reach Gaza, but added there would be no security on the ships. In other words, they're not expecting any trouble. Activists from 60 countries, as well as journalists, will take part on the trip. Israel might stop the activists in international waters and arrest everybody on the boats, or it might allow the passage. This, according to Medea Benjamin herself, co-founder of the peace group Code Pink. It will certainly provoke an international incident, and it will be very interesting to see which way the corporate media and politicians in Washington, Brussels, London and Paris, etc., which way they decide to go. Gaza Freedom Flotilla Coalition was established in 2010 by the Free Gaza Movement and the Turkish Foundation for Human Rights, Freedom and Humanitarian Relief. The coalition aims to support the Palestinian people and deliver much needed humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip by breaking the Israeli blockade of the enclave. I would advise watching that story very, very closely. It may become a case of irresistible force meets immovable object. Meanwhile, also today, the head of the World Health Organization has called for the safe passage of humanitarian aid missions throughout Gaza after an aid team failed to complete its most recent trip to the particularly hard-hit northern part of Gaza. Also today, doctors in Gaza have saved a baby from the womb of her mother as she lay dying, the mother, from head injuries sustained in an Israeli airstrike. The baby girl was delivered via emergency caesarean section at a hospital in Rafah. And to bring us up to date, the total now is at least 34,151 Palestinians have been killed and 77,000 wounded in the military offences since October the 7th. Israel says that over the same period, 260 of its troops have been killed inside the Gaza Strip during its ground operation, and 1,582 have been wounded, which inevitably invites the question, if Israel says that 260 military personnel of theirs have been killed, how many of the 34,151 Palestinians to have lost their lives were also military? But I want to make one final point about the situation and why support for the continued onslaught with the full-scale invasion of Rafah scheduled for an unknown date in the next week or two, why it continues to support, maintain such blanket support in Western capitals. And of course, we can talk about the influence of the Israel lobby. But central to the whole definitions is the fact that Israel, of course, operates as a state, a nation state, and enjoys all the trappings of diplomatic status that a nation state benefits from. Palestine, the Gaza Strip, is not a nation state. That's what the vote last week was all about, to recognize Palestinian statehood. That's why the Israelis are so irate about the possibility of Spain, or the likelihood rather, the imminent likelihood of Spain, Ireland, Slovenia, and other European countries recognizing Palestine as a state. Because in a war between two countries, then ultimately there has to be peace. There has to be peace talks. And what's more, the representatives of each country are accorded a degree of respect. However, the Palestinians are represented only by an organization, Hamas. Previously, I'm sure you remember the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And it is much easier to designate an organization a terrorist organization than it is to designate a state a terrorist state. Hence, in the simplistic thinking of people on Capitol Hill, it's very black and white. Israel, a key ally, is a nation state, and it is fighting terrorists. It is not fighting another country. It is merely fighting an organization. As a result, we see what happens. An entirely one-sided approach by the international community to the conflict. If Palestine was recognized as a state, then the whole equation would have to be very, very different, and the Israelis would be forced to the negotiating table. Where else in a war between two countries do you see one side calling for the total annihilation of the other, as is the case with Israel and Hamas? It simply isn't possible. In the other conflicts going on in the world, in Africa, in Sudan, there are always attempts to find a negotiated settlement, a permanent negotiated settlement. The reason why the peace talks in Qatar and Cairo have broken down in recent days is because the Israelis have no interest whatsoever in a permanent peaceful solution with Hamas. They are only interested in a pause in the fighting to get the hostages back, and then a continuation of the onslaught until every last member of Hamas, right down to the T-boy, and for that matter, the T-boy's brother, sister, mother, and children, have all been killed. We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, I'll be joined by our first guest, And we look forward to seeing you with Dirk Polman. I'm looking forward to talking to Dirk right after this short break.
TNT's Mark Morano.
Politico: German transport minister threatens, quote, indefinite driving bans on weekends to meet climate goals. Yay! Roll out the barrel. There you go. This is akin to Stalin's five-year plan, the Chinese agricultural revolution, so to speak, where bureaucrats, usually mid-level, enforce these diktats from high-level bureaucrats and politicians from big summits like UN climate summits. And each sector of the economy has goals. And if you fail to meet them, drastic action may be necessary.
Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
Whatever happened to good? It's a word that gets thrown around a lot, and it's become our automatic answer to so much.
Hey, how's things?
Good.
Your mum, your weekend?
Good, good. Is good even that good anymore? At the Salvos, we believe good deserves better. Let's reclaim its true meaning. To us, good has always been about making a difference, and good never picks or chooses who it helps. Isn't it time we all remember what good really means?
Unbiased information.
Honest and forthright.
News without the misinformation.
It doesn't matter what side you're from. What matters is what you say, the truthfulness behind it.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And welcome back to the Pelle Niroth Taylor Show with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Pelle. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined by, all the way from Berlin, regular TNT contributor and host Dirk Polman. Welcome to the program, Dirk.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Dirk, you were telling me during the break there a very serious situation developing in Ukraine. There's been talk of neo-Nazis in Ukraine for a very long time, since the beginning of this conflict, but now it seems they're getting more organized and indeed spreading into Germany. We know that the German political establishment are very concerned about the rise of the Alternative for Deutschland, the AfD, who strike me as, I'm a bit of a fan of one of their representatives in the European Parliament, Christine Friedland, is it? She talks a lot of sense. And it strikes me that that AfD represent an authentic strand of German public opinion, shall we say. Can the same thing be said about this insurgent neo-Nazi group in Ukraine? Or is this an intelligence operation? Is this more divide and rule? Is this a deliberate malfeasance of one sort or another?
The latter. You described the AfD, and I might be known that I'm left-wing, but the point is with AfD that they represent more than 20% of the German population, and they do represent them. They are not. Their rise is with a ton of interference. And it was never without obstacles. So it reminds me in a way, when I was a young man, it was the Green Party who was in a similar situation. When they came into an established chorus of people in the parliament, they were declared the demise of our culture, basically. It would be the end of everything we know. And that it was, of course, completely over the top. And the same applies now to the AfD. There's an organized spectrum from all of the political parties who are in the parliament, which is from the left party to the Green Party, which once had been declared left, they are a warmonger party meanwhile. Then you have the conservatives, you have the social democrats and the liberal party. And they all are united in condemning the AfD as a party. And that's simply because it's competition. And they have a way to go it's kind of a dialectic process, because the public, the more they work against AfD, the more support they have as being the real opposition. You can say that on major questions, like, for example, the COVID vaccination or also the Ukraine war, they are close to the only organized opposition we have in the parliament against this grand scheme political thing. And what happens now from Ukraine is that has not really been noticed. There was an extreme left-wing newspaper here in Germany who wrote about it, and it was a very good article. And then Kit Klarenberg, who writes, for example, for Gray Zone or Mint Press News or some other left-wing outlets in the Anglo-Saxon sphere, wrote an article which enlarged the whole scene. He mixed up two things that's not really important, because it's called Centuria, the organization, and there's another thing that's also called Centuria, and they're similar but not the same. But what they are is, this is a group, they are not right-wing. You cannot call them right-wing. They have a Nazi ideology, which includes biologist ideology, that they think that the Ukrainians are somehow superior, a demise for anything of democratic decisions. So they despise the democratic decisions. They think there should be a leadership that is running the country. They consider themselves superior. So for example, whereas the Italian fascists didn't have that racist strand in their ideology, they laughed at the Germans for their anti-Semitism. They considered that lunatic. That is one of the main differences between the fascists and the National Socialists. And so these people are real neo-Nazis. And they appeared first in Magdeburg, and now they are in six major cities in Germany, unobstructed by our interior intelligence, which is so shocked by the AfD that they are surveilling the AfD. They have declared the youth organization unconstitutional. But this, what is going on now from real Nazis, goes under the surface. Nobody does anything against it. And that shows you, I think, that it's simply a lie. What the intention is to keep the political situation under control. And these people, in a way, because they are a part of this larger scheme of damaging Russia, they are considered like brethren. And it reminded me, I've done a documentary about operations in the 50s, that is late 40s, early 50s in the Cold War. And that is like a rehearsal now, what we see. It was called at that time, from the CIA side, Operation Aerodynamic. The files are in the open, you can read them. And from the British side, there was another thing very interesting that went into the Baltic states, Operation Jungle, where they used German crews from Schnellboote, so very high-speed boats. The Germans had the fastest boats in World War II. And these boats with the crews were used to insert agents into the Baltic countries, which were also the Forest Brothers, as they were called, the same. So at that time, they used Nazis and neo-Nazis simply because they were the enemy of their enemy. And the same situation is, in a way, in Germany again. But you have to understand that there have been large-scale demonstrations. A lot of the youth went to the street because they consider that they have an obligation to fight against right-wing radicals, which is the AfD, which is rather, it's a right-wing party, but that is as right-wing as Trump is. That's nothing that should be under surveillance, really. It's not, but they large demonstrations for that, but that is the situation. I had my last talk I had with Wieland Toban, who is the head of the Jewish Voice for Just Peace in the Middle East. And he had a conference organized, and Yanis Varoufakis was supposed to be a speaker there, and he was banned.
Hold that thought, Dirk, because I want to talk more about Germany's crackdown on Palestinian solidarity after the break. I want to get into the high weeds with you as well about how the Greens have become the war party. That makes yes. no sense. Weren't they supposed to be adjacent to campaigns for nuclear disarmament? We'll come. We'll get into all this after these okay. headlines. We'll be right back.
Deadline. TNT Radio News.
Big news.
Yeah! For TNT, this is James O'Neill. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has pledged to intensify military and diplomatic pressure on Hamas, promising to deliver additional and painful blows in order to secure the release of Israeli hostages held in Gaza. North Korea launched several ballistic missiles into the South Sea of Japan on Monday, as confirmed by officials from South Korea and Japan. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov claimed that Ukrainian forces are deliberately targeting Russian journalists reporting from the conflict front lines.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
And welcome back to the Pelle Noroth Taylor Show with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Pelle just today. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined all the way from Berlin by Dirk Polman. And we are trying to unpick the forest of weeds that is German politics right now. I'd like to start with the vehement anti-Palestinian solidarity that comes from the German establishment, to the point of refusing entry into the country for the distinguished Palestinian British surgeon Dr. Ghassan Abu Sita, recently elected rector of Glasgow University. The major Palestinian solidarity conference that was effectively broken up by Gestapo-type police. So you've got that on the one hand, and simultaneously, the party now in coalition government, the Green Party, that those of us that grew up in the 1970s and 80s were led to believe to be peaceniks. Wasn't that the Green ideology? I mean, there's nothing more environmentally destructive than war. And yet, Annalena Baerbock, the current German foreign minister, is bending the knee and kissing the ring in Tel Aviv and doing everything to force more Ukrainian young men into the meat grinder on the Eastern Front. It's all completely topsy-turvy, Dirk.
It is. It is. I remember the time very well, because that's after I finished school, went to university. This is when the Greens rose. And I remember being glued to my radio at that time when the first speech in the German parliament of a then conservative member of parliament, Herbert Gruhl, who had these ecological ideas, gave a speech. And that was groundbreaking. It was like suddenly you'd hear something from the parliament which was completely new. And he didn't become a member of the Greens, but that was part of this new movement, which was, as you said, it was completely anti-war. It was pacifist from large scale. In the first foreign policy paper that they wrote, which I might still have somewhere here, is the things were that the West should get out of NATO, the Eastern Bloc countries should leave Warsaw Pact, both blocs should be abolished, and the intelligence agencies of both systems should also completely be abolished. So that was in the first foreign policy paper of the Green Party. And at that time, I was, we were drafted into the military at that time. And I was one of the rare cases being a leftist who joined the German military. And at that time, I got a ton of flack from all my colleagues. Nobody could understand that. And especially if you were close to the Greens, it was impossible to do that. Simply stating, which was my point, that I said, I will use my freedom of speech, so I give back to the state my guarantee that I will defend the state. That was out on the right wing already. Yeah. So these were the Greens. They were all conscientious objectors. And now you have the same people who are becoming armchair generals, whereas our military in Germany, like Harald Kujat, the former head of NATO, the highest soldier that Germany ever had, became head of NATO, and General Watt, who was the advisor for Angela Merkel, they advise caution right now. They are the ones stepping on the brake and saying this is going into the wrong directions, where the Greens desperately tried to put the gas pedal down and speed towards this war in Ukraine. It's completely, as you said, it's not really, although I witnessed it, I couldn't understand what went on. It really started with the Yugoslavian war, where Joschka Fischer, head of the Greens and always an alpha male, he was always the alpha male. He was the alpha male. He was part of an organization street fighter students were called the Proletarian Union for Terror and Destruction. He was the head of that, fighting the policemen on the street, and later on became the dearest buddy of Madeleine Albright. And he said during the Yugoslav war, which was illegal, from every perspective that you look at, from a law perspective, he said the question is either Auschwitz again or joining the war. That was the either or situation that he painted, which of course was not true, but that was the start. And from there on, you could see, and now they are talking about moral politics. And I think morality in politics leads you to something that can... It can end in something like the French Revolution, the Committee for, what is it called in English? I don't know. Robespierre, where they, Committee for, yeah.
Public
so
safety.
It usually ends in mass killings. And the point is, if you are a realpolitik person, then it's always the possibility of negotiation. If you are into this feminist foreign policy or moral foreign policy like Anna Baerbock, and I would compare her to Joe Biden, she also wanted to be very dear to Joe Biden. And you can say if these people are the heading, the foreign policy or the United States, it's not them. Somebody else is doing it because they are not capable. I mean, Joe Biden is something like a wandering mummy. And Annalena Baerbock is not the brightest candle on the cake, really. Yeah. So this is what happens. But she's always there and said, we have to. Sentences always begin with we have to, and then comes something. And what happened with the Israeli case, that of course Germany is deeply, deeply, it's defined by the Holocaust. And the German position was never something like this again. This is what we have been heard in school and university, and we really swallowed that. And but for the Israelis, for example, is completely different. It's never again being a victim. It means you need weapons. You need to be able to fight. Completely different situation. But this leads together now. There's a state. It's not Jews. Careful with it's not that there's, as I had this Wilfried Hoban, who is a peacenik Jew, very rare breed in Israel, meanwhile. But Israel, it's at the same time, it depicts itself like always an eternal victim, where under this disguise, it can do incredible things in their foreign policy. And Germany.
We don't have much time left, Dirk. I want to ask you two very quick questions. As a leftist in Germany now and a peacenik, do you find yourself politically homeless?
Yes. Yes, short answer is yes. There's nothing left except maybe Sarah Wagenknecht when she comes, but there's really no strong movement. There's no force, no intellectual force.
And Germany built its entire foreign policy after the war on peace with Russia because of the nightmare of 39-45, and with so many killed on both sides, the Eastern Front was horrific, all the rest of it. That seems to have been abandoned extremely quickly. Why is that?
That is inexplicable to me. It's the Social Democratic part was Adenauer. Basically, we have to adhere to the West. That will protect us from communism. That was the conservative view, and we have to. On the other hand, it is the utmost of the little national sovereignty that we could have. And Adenauer was not in connection with Nazis, really. He not himself, but he used all Nazis all the time because there were so many. Then came the Social Democrats, as you described, détente policy. And even then, Helmut Schmidt. Schmidt is again is a little shift. Schmidt is very is part. It's also very much Atlanticist. The thing was Bahr and Brandt. They were the detente policy people for Germany, and that was. But I can tell you, Brandt would be thrown out of the Social Democratic Party today with the ideas that he had at that time. So something very deeply changed. And it's like in Sweden, where if I talk to Pelle, it's hard to understand how Sweden, the neutral Sweden, the nice people from Europe, suddenly turned into fans of the NATO. Hard to understand. Yeah, would be a long hour talk that we could have on that. It's yes. I don't understand it, honestly.
Yeah. Last point very quickly. I did see a couple of weeks ago Gerhard Schroeder, the former chancellor, saying he hoped his personal relationship with Vladimir Putin might be in some way useful for bringing an end to the war. Does anybody give him any credence? Is there any hope for that?
He's an outcast. Right now, you could say the movement is a little bit that he is, because he has some value in this possibility to talk, that it's getting stronger. But what I look like to remind is that the German Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, he made this pipeline deal, which at that time in the 80s was it was always hated by the Americans, that Europe, which included Britain at that time, Margaret Thatcher also had the pipeline, that she was in favor of that. They didn't like that one bit. And that was what Helmut Schmidt stood for. And that is also a reason why the Americans wanted him out and Kohl in. And I think Schröder never forget that. So I think his relationship with Gazprom is kind of an answer to this American, we don't know very much about it, I would have to tell you about it, but the American operations against Helmut Schmidt to get him out of the government and Kohl in, that is something which I consider is one of the reasons why Schröder had this very close situation regarding gas and Putin. So that is historically, there is a historic background to that.
Oh, there might have been some kind of soft coup against Schmidt back in the day.
That's what I've been told by an American colleague, the former UPI intelligence correspondent Richard Sale. I have this still on an interview where he told me that the Reagan government was, there were the liberal Democrats who were on a coalition with Schmidt. And Schmidt was toppled by a vote of no confidence in parliament, not by an election. And they did that. This is what the guy told me, that we had to put a bucket of money on the scale. It was very easy in Germany to shift that. That is something that never has been really investigated. I tried to do it, and I was really stopped by my TV station in Germany.
I'm afraid I've got to stop you. Another TV station has to stop you. Fascinating. I really, really would like to get into this in a great more detail with you, and I hope we have the opportunity soon. Dirk Polman, thank you very much indeed for joining us today on TNT.
Good show.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, I'll be joined by Dr. Anna Lemke, who is a professor at Stanford University in California. And it's a hard pivot. I'll be asking her why dopamine controls everything we do. We'll be right back after this short break.
My baby's back from the West Coast.
Hear those pictures that you asked for your school project? First day of school, cute as a button.
So long ago.
Oh, here's Grandma Florence after that flood wiped out the whole neighborhood.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Those beans smell heavenly.
Give Mom a little credit.
You know what? We should make an emergency communication plan. That way we're ready this year.
Oh, that's a great idea.
At my dorm, we have emergency kits for earthquakes and wildfires, but I'm sure there's something more local I can send you with a link.
Okay.
Smart.
I'm coming to share with you guys.
Protect your legacy. Plan for natural disasters today. Visit ready.gov/plan.
Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome. Prediabetes does. One in three adults has prediabetes. But with early diagnosis, prediabetes can be reversed. And you can change the outcome. Take the one-minute prediabetes risk test today. Go to doihaveprediabetes.org.
Geopolitical commentator and investigative journalist. You're listening to Pella Nuroff-Taylor on today's News Talk. TNT.
And welcome back to the Pella Nuroff-Taylor Show with me, Basil Valentine, in for Pella just for today. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Professor Dr. Anna Lemke of Stanford University. Now, forgive this curveball, but I do want to get this story in. And that is Papua New Guinea's leader dismissing President Joe Biden's suggestion that his uncle may have fallen prey to cannibals in Papua New Guinea during the Second World War. Now, I'm given to believe that everything we do is controlled by dopamine. Does that include cannibalism, Dr. Anna?
Well, it probably does. I mean, if it's a ritual that is rewarding, especially if shared socially with others, it's likely to be reinforcing in our, you know, primitive lizard brain, sometimes referred to as the triune brain. So yes, probably. But I haven't done the studies myself. Basil, I haven't done the studies myself.
It wasn't a facetious question. It was a genuine question. The Papua New Guinea leader was rather upset by the remark, as you can imagine, and we've no idea whether Joe was serious about it. I don't think he's got any idea what he was saying. But do please go on and expound for the benefit of our viewers and listeners. Dopamine is the pleasure center of the brain, am I right?
Well, dopamine is actually a chemical that we make in our brain that is released in the pleasure center of the brain, more often referred to as a circuit or a network or a pathway, because it consists not just of one brain area, but of multiple brain areas. Broadly speaking, the prefrontal cortex right behind our foreheads, and then those deeper sort of midbrain limbic structures that are very rich in neurons that release dopamine. So it's a neurotransmitter, and it's important for the experience of pleasure, reward, and motivation.
Are all of us slaves to our, you know, to the creation of dopamine, from which I assume we get the term dope, referring to narcotics of one sort or another? I've seen experiments where, you know, rats will sort of starve themselves to death if they can get a hit of pleasure in some other direction. And of course, there have been cases recently of people dying while plugged into video games, you know, unable to eat or sleep for days on end because, you know, they're so addicted to the thrill that these games provide.
Right. I think one way to think about dopamine is that it's a very old chemical that is essential for our survival, especially in a world of scarcity and ever-present danger. It's what motivates us to do the work to get natural rewards like food, clothing, shelter, finding a mate, which is essential for survival. The problem is that through innovation, science, and technology, we've managed to take these healthy rewards and turn them into very potent drugs. And not just things we ingest, also things we do, especially now things that we do on the internet and through, you know, digital media, which are highly reinforcing for the human brain. And, you know, when you ask, are we all slaves to our dopamine? Not necessarily, but potentially, which is to say, when we repeatedly expose our brains to highly rewarding substances and behaviors, what happens is that we change our brain chemistry such that we do or can become slaves to the dopamine fluctuations and looking always to get more potent forms in ever greater quantities as a way to maintain homeostasis, a way that neuroscientists talk about, a kind of brain equilibrium. So yes, we are now seeing people getting addicted to digital media. to video games, to online pornography, online shopping, social media, you name it. Very sadly, we are seeing people who are literally having their survival threatened because they cannot disengage from this medium.
Well, I would suppose the way out of this is education more than anything else, isn't it? That, man, know thyself. We all need to understand the way we work a bit better if we are to lead balanced lives. There's certainly a place for dopamine, the pleasure principle, but that doesn't necessarily mean we all have to end up as brothel creepers or opium eaters, does it?
I agree with you that education is essential. And I do think that understanding the neuroscience and how our brains work resonates for modern people and can help them. But I also think that that's not probably going to be sufficient in the long run. One of the biggest risk factors for addiction is simple access to our drug of choice. If we grow up in a neighborhood where drugs are readily available, we're more likely to use them and more likely to get addicted to them. We now live in a world of 24/7 digital media. Every part of our lives has become integrated with this technology. And if we happen to be an individual for whom the digital medium is particularly reinforcing, then we are really, really vulnerable. So I think that it's not just going to be what we as individuals can learn and know and do. It is also going to require top-down efforts, efforts on behalf of the federal government, the corporations that make and profit from digital media, the school system, which has highly incorporated technology into education. And these entities are going to help us as a society create guardrails so that we can protect ourselves. And we do that already in many ways with drugs, for example. Some drugs are illegal. Legal drugs have age limits on them. You can't obtain them until you reach a certain age of adulthood. Manufacturers are not allowed to market or sell their products to children. In the United States, children are not allowed to go into a casino and gamble. They're not allowed to buy cigarettes. Children are not allowed to buy alcohol. And I think we have to think about digital media in a similar type of way and also make sure that while protecting privacy, we also limit access to the most vulnerable individuals.
Particularly the young. I have several friends with children aged between sort of 8 and 16 or some who were aged in that age group, and they have had the most unbelievable difficulty with addiction to these online games on the iPads to the extent that healthy, well-balanced kid enjoyed playing sport, discovered this online game in which he plays against his friends and doesn't want to do anything else at all, and when they take the iPad away, it's the biggest disaster in the world. They have to deal with very, very serious tantrums of the kind that the boy had never displayed before. Absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, what you're describing is something that is happening across the world. I really think that the sort of sentinel events or sentinel warnings about the addictive potential of digital media is coming from parents of teenagers and even younger children. And we need to pay attention to that. It is real. Not everybody, again, will become addicted to digital media, just like not everybody who drinks alcohol will become an alcoholic. But for a certain subset of otherwise healthy children and adults, this medium is going to be incredibly cognitively adherent and compelling. And the tantrums you describe, that's probably genuine physiologic withdrawal. Just like people who have been using heroin and stop will go into opioid withdrawal, people who have been using constant digital media, games, pornography, whatever it is, who then get it taken away will go into a physiologic withdrawal. Now, we have to have them go through that in order for them to come to the other side and kind of, recapture their brains and get their frontal lobes back online. So it's a painful, painful reality, but it speaks to really the incredible change in physiology that happens when we expose our brains to these highly reinforcing media.
It's Speaking of opioids, massive epidemic, of course, in the United States. Every time I go to social media, I see the most appalling scenes of sort of zombified individuals on the streets of Philadelphia, San Francisco, and elsewhere, seemingly sort of slumped over, motionless, most of them. Some of them are even standing like that. I think that's what fentanyl does to you. Where did this come from? Is it the result of Big Pharma?
Yeah, to understand what happened to the opioid epidemic in North America, it's really important to go back to the late 1990s and look at Purdue Pharma and the way that they pushed and marketed their opioid product, OxyContin. And there was a fourfold increase in opioid prescribing in the United States between 1999 and 2011. And as opioid prescribing increased, so too did opioid addiction and opioid-related overdose deaths. Beginning approximately in 2012, as people became aware that people were dying from prescription opioids, opioid prescribing decreased, and then people who were addicted turned to illicit sources like heroin, which is an illicit opioid, as well as illicit fentanyl, which is a very potent pharmaceutical opioid that you can get from a doctor, but that now is made and manufactured in illegal pharmacies and illegal laboratories, and it's very addictive, very potent, and also very, very deadly. And so two-thirds to three-quarters of the opioid-related overdose today are caused by illegal or illicit fentanyl.
A lot of it smuggled across the southern border, of course. Similarly, there's a big problem with prescription drugs, which I can't help thinking stems largely from the fact that physicians are rewarded for prescribing them. So unless we can break the connection between the drug companies and the people prescribing them and start putting patients first, that isn't going to end anytime soon, is it, Anna?
Yeah, you're targeting the fundamental problem, which at least here in the United States, we have a healthcare system that essentially incentivizes prescribing drugs and doing procedures over the kind of slow medicine that probably in the long run is a better intervention for things like chronic pain and mental illness. It's not to say the medicines should go away entirely. They're important tools to have in our toolbox. But unfortunately, what we have now is, again, a healthcare system that incentivizes doctors to prescribe because it reimburses better, it takes less time, and frankly, because in the short term,
speaking of time, we're out of time, Anna. Do join us again on TNT. I'm Basil Valentine, sitting in for Pelly Noel Taylor. Don't go away. More after the headlines. We'll be right back.